So over to Eden. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. So this morning, our first talk is from Michael Wee. His talk is on euthanasia and assisted suicide, ethics and contemporary challenges. Michael Wee is the Education and Research Officer of the Anscombe Bioethics Centre, an independent research institute based in Oxford. He is also Associate Lecturer in Bioethics at Oscott Seminary in Birmingham, and is a regular speaker in universities and schools across the country, across the UK. His writings appeared in the Public Discourse, the Catholic Herald, and the Church Life Journal. So big round of applause to Michael. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I can hear it's a bit loud.
Okay, if you can't hear me, just raise your hands. I think this should be fine. Thank you very much to Anthony, to Eden, and the whole team at Spark for inviting me to speak on the not-so-cheery topic of euthanasia at 9:30 in the morning. So if you're not a morning person, I sympathise, because I'm not either. And I thought I should say, Eden mentioned, I'm Michael. I'm from the Anscombe Bioethics Centre. If you haven't noticed already, I'm not related to Udru. Unlike some of you here who are more fortunate than I am. I thought I'd tell you a bit more about the Anscombe Centre before we dive straight in. So, can you hear me? Okay, I'll try to... So, the Anscombe Centre is an independent research institute based in Oxford. We are, in effect, the National Catholic Bioethics Centre for the UK and Ireland. We were founded in 1977. By the English Catholic bishops, which makes us the oldest national bioethics centre in the UK. And a lot of the work that we do involves the academic side of things, of research, scholarship, and we also do public education. And obviously, I know not everyone here is Catholic or religious. In some ways, I will be speaking at least from a Catholic background or perspective, but hopefully not using arguments that will be inaccessible to everyone here. I should say that on the subject of euthanasia not being so cheery and being a Catholic bioethicist in particular, we all know that particularly those of us who are religious and who hold positions as we do on pro-life matters, it's always an uphill task, isn't it? First of all, we've got to fend off people who say, oh no, you just believe that because you're religious. Right. And then on top of that, there's the perception of the Catholic Church or Christianity in general as just saying no to everything. Right. And even Catholics sometimes, lend support to this impression. I have a friend who, when he was an undergraduate, one of the new encyclicals of the Pope came out, and he and his Catholic friends were gathered in a room, and one of their fellow Catholic students burst in and said, "Have you seen the Pope's new encyclical? It's great. It condemns everything." Okay, so that's the way people think about Catholic bioethics, and it's not a complete falsehood. Obviously, it's partially true. It's a truth, but it's a half truth, because there's so much else that pro-lifers, that Catholics, that all of us here who believe in a consistent life ethic say yes to. We don't just condemn everything. So I'm hopefully going to end off this talk, and you will hold me to this promise, I'm sure, with a bit of a positive note of hope. And I believe this applies to just about every single pro-life issue that all of us will encounter in our lives, in our work as pro-lifers. That it cannot just be no. We have to offer a positive message of hope as well. So today's topic, this morning's topic, euthanasia and assisted suicide. Plug for the website, bioethics.org.uk. It's very easy to remember. Euthanasia and assisted suicide. Now, I don't know, you might disagree with me, but I often get the sense, and maybe this is partly my own gut feel, partly from my interactions with fellow young pro-lifers, not so young, that we focus a lot about abortion, and rightly so. I do believe abortion, our fight against abortion is one of the most important human rights challenges of our day, as John Deacon was very eloquently saying so last night. That's absolutely true, but somehow we're less well equipped, or even dare I say, less interested in talking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. Last term in Oxford, where I'm based, I was giving a whole 8-week series of talks on Catholic bioethics, and we had lots of people coming for our talks. You know, the room was full when it was topics like abortion, contraception, even IVF, organ donation. We had more than 30 people come. And the day that it was euthanasia, it dropped to 15. Okay, so this room being full cheers me incredibly. But why is that? So it made me think why that might be. Is it because we think it's a long way off from where we are right now? That unless we've got some, you know, a relative in a care home or a hospice or somebody we know who's terminally ill, we might think that, well, this challenge is for another day. Well, all of us are at the age where we might know somebody who's pregnant or who might even have had an abortion, or at least a crisis pregnancy. Euthanasia and assisted suicide seems like, you know, something for a different generation. Maybe because it's difficult to argue about, right? When we are confronted with the pro-abortion activist who says, my body, my rights, well, we can say, well, you can do what you want with your body, more or less, but the unborn child isn't your body. And that doesn't apply to euthanasia. It doesn't apply to suicide, to assisted suicide. So maybe it's more difficult rhetorically for us to argue about, and that's why people shy away from the topic. Or maybe we think that there are no looming threats in the UK. I mean, we know in the last couple of weeks, the last couple of months, Parliament has become very good at saying no to the same thing over and over again. And that's sometimes quite a good thing, especially when it comes to euthanasia and assisted suicide. Whether it's a good thing or in breadth, I'm not going to comment. But when it comes to euthanasia and assisted suicide, well, we know that the Faulkner Bill in the House of Lords was defeated over and over again in the House of Lords, although with smaller margins of victory each time. The Morris Bill in 2015, which was the last serious attempt in Westminster to push a bill forward for assisted dying, was defeated by over 200 votes in the House of Commons. So you might be tempted to think that, well, you know, this is really a fight for another day in all senses of the word. Well, let me just give you a sense of why all this might not be so. Is it really a long way off from where we are now as young people? Now, a couple of years ago, Public Health England did a big study on the leading causes of death, broken down by age and by gender in the UK. And it gave, among its findings, it said that, well, Brits are living longer than ever, but they're also in poorer health, which should raise some alarm bells for this topic. The leading cause of death for the elderly, for those over 80, was dementia. Now, can anyone guess for the age group from sort of above 10 up to 35, both men and women, what is the biggest killer of young people in the UK? Suicide. Overwhelmingly so, for both men and women. Suicide is the biggest killer. So we're not just talking about, when it comes to, I know, assisted suicide, euthanasia, we think of that as something for old people, for the terminally ill. I mean, that's how it's often sold in countries where there's a push for it to be legalised. Don't forget, of course, just across the channel, really, Belgium has legalised child euthanasia. And we'll say a bit more about the impact of euthanasia on overall suicide rates later on. Now, you might have seen the news recently of the Royal College of Physicians holding what might be described as a rigged survey on assisted suicide. A couple of years ago, they polled their doctor members. 58% or so said they were against assisted suicide. And so the Royal College of Physicians has had a traditional stance of opposition to assisted suicide. Indeed, I do believe, and I haven't looked at the statistics, but probably, even if a majority of people in the UK might support some form of euthanasia or assisted suicide, doctors are far less likely to be supportive, in part because they're the ones who are going to have to do it, right? So, and now the Royal College of Physicians has put forward a new survey, not a yes or no, but a yes, no, or neutral, and they say they will only maintain their stance of being against assisted suicide if the no votes get over 60%. And that's clearly, people talk about the second referendum being rigged. This is what it means to rig a referendum, right? When you have not two but three votes and you demand. Basically, the upshot is that any group can then come in and say, well, are we sure we're against this? Let's have a poll and you've got to have 60%. Right, so that's what's happening at the moment, and there's going to be a court case to challenge the legality of this survey. Now, this is an interesting one. I don't know if you might what to think of this. Now, since the Mental Capacity Act, 2005, I think it was, gives a legal framework by which you can make advanced decisions to withdraw or to refuse life-sustaining treatment. It would be legally binding. It would be valid as a legal document if certain conditions are met, which are spelled out by the law. And now, obviously, I'm not against, I'm sure most of you would not be against, withdrawing life-sustaining treatment, at least in some circumstances. Right? Now, if you Google advanced decision or advanced decision UK, most likely after the first one or two NHS websites, you'll get this charity called Compassion in Dying, giving you this resource pack on how to make an advanced decision. Now, I should say that Compassion in Dying is a sister organisation of Dignity in Dying, one of the leading campaigning groups for assisted suicide in the UK. And I looked at their resource pack on advanced decisions, and you can make advanced decisions in various different ways. You can say, well, in the event of such and such, I only want such and such treatment to be given, but not X, Y, Z. You can also fill in an advanced statement, which is not legally binding, but it's just a broader statement of your wishes, your beliefs, religious, philosophical, whatever it is. Now, the Compassion in Dying resource pack only gives you one way of doing things, which is I wish for all life-saving treatment to be withdrawn in the case of, and then you can tick dementia, brain death, this and that. All life-sustaining treatment, including, I should add, food and water, clinically assisted nutrition and hydration. Right, people talk about, legitimate withdrawing treatment when treatment becomes so burdensome that it's just, it's just morally difficult to carry on with such treatment. And when you withdraw the treatment, you can say you're letting nature take its course. You die from the underlying disease. That's not necessarily euthanasia. But when somebody removes food and water, even if it's clinically assisted, given by a feeding tube, the person doesn't die of the underlying disease, they die of starvation and dehydration. So that's what's happening. And of course they will say, well, this has got nothing to do with our campaign for assisted suicide. But it's not difficult to join the dots, at least, and to see how this might then be interpreted as the law allowing some kind of covert euthanasia or assisted suicide anyway, and therefore we should have an open change. So that's what's going on. And I should say that, as I mentioned earlier on, they give you, you can say, I wish all life-sustaining treatment to be withdrawn, and you can tick the conditions to which that will apply. And the first condition is, it's not brain injury or anything debilitating like that, it's dementia. And we know that dementia is not a disease that leaves you hooked up to machines ordinarily, right? So I strongly suspect what might go on in that case. I mean, a person who has dementia, in terms of ordinary medical needs, they don't need a ventilator. They don't need to have feeding tubes. So what it might mean is that if a person has dementia and then they contract, say, pneumonia or something, then the advanced decision might kick in to say, well, don't give them the medication for this. And that doesn't sound to me like a legitimate form of withdrawing medical treatment. So what's the paradigm case of euthanasia, of why euthanasia should be legalised from the point of view of campaigners and advocates? Now, the paradigm case goes like this. You've got somebody who is suffering unbearably or intolerably, as the language is often used. they're terminally ill, they're going to die anyway, quote unquote. Maybe they have a prognosis, or it could be a couple of days, weeks, or maybe 6 months. That's the gold standard for euthanasia campaigners. 6 months. They're going to die anyway, they're in great pain. If you give them a lethal dose and help them die painlessly, well, they were going to die anyway, so aren't you just helping them along in the natural process? Furthermore, you're going to save them days or weeks or months of needless suffering. That's the paradigm case, and of course put forward under the name of compassion. That's sometimes people use the example of a soldier in a battlefield dying from a gunshot wound, and there's no medic. You know that. But anyway, as far as medicine, modern medicine goes, this is the paradigm case of euthanasia, of why euthanasia should be legalized. And then, of course, they would say, well, furthermore, quite often doctors give pain relief, say morphine, opiates, which have the side effect of shortening life, of hastening death. Isn't that the same thing anyway as euthanasia? Or, as I've just mentioned, people do withdraw say, chemotherapy or other forms of life-sustaining treatment, which invariably has the consequence, the side effect, at least, of leading towards their death. So isn't that the same thing anyway? Now that's the argument, the official argument in many circles for euthanasia. Now, some of you might have heard about the slippery slope of euthanasia. Now, in actual fact, there are two slippery slopes, because what we hear of the paradigm case so often then becomes, so it goes from unbearable suffering, they're going to die anyway. It goes very quickly from that to, well, it's all about my body, my rights. It's all about autonomy. They should be able to die whenever they want. Anyone should be able to have the right to die. So there are really two slippery slopes in the context of euthanasia and assisted suicide. One is the first case, the paradigm case, where euthanasia is presented as a kind of medicine to alleviate suffering. Now, if euthanasia is medicine in that sense, where it's just another tool of alleviating suffering, like your painkillers, like sedatives, then logically, based on what is medical best practice at the moment, based on all kinds of professionally accepted best standards and practices in medicine, then euthanasia can also be done without the consent of the patient, because we quite often doctors make decisions in emergency situations on behalf of the patient, or if the patient is unconscious, somebody else who has a lasting power of attorney can make decisions on their behalf. So why not euthanasia if it's a form of medicine just like any other? That is the logic. That is one of the two slippery slopes. And we see this already happening in Belgium, which has had euthanasia for over 15 years legalized in the country. So we have the reported euthanasia figures, and people think that there are also lots of cases of euthanasia that are simply not reported in Belgium. Then you have this grey area, this twilight zone, called continuous sedation at the end of life. Now, sedation can be used legitimately at the end of life to help pain relief in very, very serious pain, where it's not enough just to give painkillers. Sometimes helping the person, basically go to get some rest, fall asleep, that in itself could be a very, very powerful, quite drastic, but a powerful and effective and legitimate way of pain relief. Now, what happens quite often in Belgium, unlike in the UK, where sedatives are titrated proportionately to symptoms, what happens quite often in Belgium when people are approaching the end of life is that they're given a huge dose of sedatives, which makes them go into a very, very long period of unconsciousness during which they die. Perhaps, I'm not sure if it's from dehydration, if the fluids are removed, or simply from whatever else is happening in the dying process or in their illness. Now, a survey of doctors who who have performed this show that in fact there are some doctors, maybe about 15% or so, who in fact perform continuous sedation at the end of life with the intention to kill or shorten life. And in a small number of cases of overall sedation at the end of life in Belgium, this is done without the consent of the patient or even the family. It's hard to give exact numbers because these are not reported. This is euthanasia on the sly, as it were. But it's a real problem. So my wife is from Belgium, and we regularly have conversations with family and friends about these matters, which are very, very close to home. And one of the things my wife was reflecting on once was that one of the scary things is that sometimes when an elderly relative dies, you're not totally sure how they died. Because especially if they were unconscious in their final days, in their final weeks, and somebody else is making a decision on their behalf. What if somebody has two children, one of whom supports euthanasia and the other one doesn't, and the one who supports euthanasia was able to talk to the doctor first? These are very, very real issues facing people in Belgium. Dr. Peter Saunders, whom you saw in Udo's documentary last night, I heard him once, when I heard him speak a couple of years ago, I remember him saying that in relation to abortion and euthanasia, that the generation that killed their children will now